Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack. I'm Chris. I'm Harlan Levy. Today, I'll be reading from the March 11th issue of The New Yorker magazine. The article is titled, Role Play, by Ronan Farrow. Recently, the drag star RuPaul Andre Charles has taken to falling asleep while watching the documentary series, Secrets of Great British Castles. He's seen every episode, knows every turn in the bloody histories of landmarks like Dover Castle and the Tower of London. The headline is, Humans have been horrible since the beginning of time, RuPaul told me. And the human ego can justify these terrible things that people do. You know, these kings, Henry VIII and Edward II, and all these people who have just decimated hundreds of thousands of people because their feelings were hurt. I'm fearing the absolute worst, he said. Humans on this planet are in the cycle of destruction. I am plotting a safety net. He was referring to a fortified compound being constructed on the 60,000-acre ranch of his husband, George LeBar, in Wyoming. I wouldn't call it a bunker, he said, but it is designed to withstand calamity. It's a lot of concrete and a lot of things. I keep thinking about these castles that I'm going to bed to. I met RuPaul at the end of January in Britain at a rented cottage in Windsor and at Pinewood Studios nearby, where movie franchises including James Bond and Harry Potter have been filmed. He was shooting RuPaul's Drag Race UK, one of 19 regional variations of his competition reality show, while promoting a memoir, which will be published this week, called The House of Hidden Meanings. The title comes from a friend's comment during an acid trip. After the drugs wore off, he writes, I realized it was nonsense. RuPaul now hosts 7 versions of Drag Race, a pastiche of competition reality television tropes that follows participants in and out of drag through eclectic challenges, including costume making, lip-syncing, and stand-up comedy, testing charisma, uniqueness, nerve, and talent. The resulting acronym is representative of the show's bawdy sense of humor. He has taken an underground, subversive form and made it so mainstream that Nancy Pelosi has appeared as a guest on the show. The 16th season of the U.S. version, currently airing, has some of its highest ratings yet, and RuPaul recently won his 14th Emmy, making him the most decorated competition host and the most decorated person of color in the awards history. Drag Race often focuses on competitors who are profoundly marginalized. Almost all the drag queens on the show are queer, and many are people of color who come from backgrounds where they faced homophobia, racism, or transphobia. For them, drag can be a lifeline, affording a sense of community and an opportunity to transmute stigmatized traits into something exuberant. Yet, as Drag Race has become mainstream, a burgeoning culture war has demonized its subject matter. In the past year, lawmakers in at least 15 states have attempted to ban drag shows, part of a wider queer panic. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, more than 400 bills that the organization identifies as anti-LGBTQ+ are currently under consideration around the country, featuring provisions like curriculum censorship, facilities bans, and mandates that schools staff out young people to their families. Drag performances, particularly for child audiences, have recently been canceled in at least 7 countries where Drag Race airs. RuPaul, 63, is the world's most famous drag queen, at the helm of one of the world's most far-reaching platforms for queer expression. In conservative communities around the country and the world, he often serves as a way into queer culture. And for those set against that culture, he represents the dangerous spread of liberal ideas. One of RuPaul's favorite responses to anyone who asks how he's doing is, I don't see how that's any of your business. This is a bit, but it's also something of a life philosophy. Ru, he is a study in the private and the public self, Barbato said. He's a public figure, and he's extraordinarily private. I have twice appeared as a judge on the American Drag Race programs, but our interviews in England were our first substantive exchange. We sat in a small dressing room dominated by RuPaul's hair and makeup collection, which covered four plastic picnic tables, and by the man himself, who is 6'4", but is often thought to be taller, probably on account of all the killer heels. RuPaul, on a break between shooting segments, in which he would appear out of drag, was without the heels, and instead wore fuzzy gray slippers, a black Abbey Road hoodie, and black workout pants. "I did not think this memoir shit through," he told me, shaking his head. "It's presumptuous that the interviewer can interpret my experience." There's some irony in this. Like many reality shows, Drag Race is subject to complaints from competitors who feel unfairly reduced to archetypes. It's nothing like what happened on set. Fifi O'Hara, who was portrayed as hostile toward other contestants, told New York Magazine. RuPaul once recorded a song about the complaints. "Blame it on the edit," singing, "You, the one who said it, bitch. How you gonna regret it? To me," he said, "we've had kids come on the show and we put a camera on them, which can be like a mirror, and they see the reflection of themselves and go, oh no, that is not who I am. They must have done something to make me look like that. Like Blanche DuBois, they will not see it. Then they will fight to the end to say, I was tampered with. No, we don't do that." RuPaul's drag and out-of-drag personas in the show are essentially characters. In drag, he's the candy-colored Diana Ross meets Bugs Bunny meets Dolly Parton character he's built an empire around. The drag looks featured in each episode take 4 to 6 hours to create. His makeup artist, a former contestant named Raven, said, "We do a little brush, we take a break, coffee talk. Okay, let's get back to it." In the show's out-of-drag segments, where he introduces challenges or checks in on contestants, offering mentorship and advice, he plays a cheerful, avuncular, professorial type, complete with eyeglasses that he doesn't really need. Drag's evolution from edgy nightclub reviews to family programming has predictably spurred criticism. What was once counterculture has simply become the culture, E. Alex Young wrote in New York Magazine in 2019. This has its benefits. Mainstream consumer culture has gotten a little less straight. But in the process, something, maybe the feeling that this was by us and for us, was lost. RuPaul argued that the full spectrum of drag continues to flourish. The form, he told me, doesn't need defending. Even people who work with him closely can find him distant. His appearances on camera are executed like military strikes. He spends relatively little time with panelists and contestants. He mentioned a former colleague who worked with him for decades. "We kept a working relationship. We traveled the world together," he said. "But sometimes I would hear her talking to a friend, and she'd be talking about her latest boyfriend. She never did that with me, because I'm her boss." One of RuPaul's foundational beliefs is that, as he said, everybody's playing a role. At times, he plays a nurturing one. A staple of Drag Race is an interview that finalists have with RuPaul. It is often a lunch conducted over a bowl of Tic Tacs, in which they tell him their hopes and fears, and he dispenses therapeutic wisdom. It's easy to dismiss these exchanges as superficial, but they can be a genuine source of strength for competitors. Jinx Monsoon recalled that during their lunch segment, he was like, "You don't need to make yourself smaller for other people." And he said that, and it was amazing, because it did make me feel like, oh, I don't have to feel guilty for being talented. At other times, RuPaul can appear cold, a quality born of painful experience. So much of our culture today, with young people, is centered around their feelings, he told me. Feelings are indicators. They're not facts, he went on. Parents teaching their kids about safe spaces, and I feel uncomfortable. It's like, you know what? The world is not a safe space. You have to find the comfort. It's mostly uncomfortable. He told me that he has never wanted children. I don't like kids, he said flatly. RuPaul was born in San Diego in 1960, the third of four children, and the only boy, and brought up in a yellow three-bedroom tract house, one of four models in a housing development called Michelle Manor. According to family lore, before he was born, a fortune teller told his mother, Ernestine, that the baby would be famous. Ernestine introduced him to his aunts by saying, "His name is RuPaul, and he's going to be a star." I was always anointed, he told me. I know it sounds obnoxious, but I knew from childhood I was the golden child. His father, Irving, who worked as an electrician at an aerospace company, was a charming philanderer with a gambling problem. Ernestine, who was of Creole descent, was flinty and aloof, with an immaculate sense of style. Her eviscerating barbs earned her the nickname Mean Miss Charles among the neighborhood kids. She was a mess, one of Rue's older sisters, Renetta, has said, referring to their mother's temper. Said what she felt, meant what she said, and you dealt with it. The parents' fights could be cataclysmic. At one point, Ernestine poured gasoline over Irving's convertible, an Oldsmobile Delta 88, and threatened him with a matchbook. RuPaul told me they were embroiled in their own two battling nations, and I'm in the middle. So I learned how to be a diplomat and read the situation and go, oh, can't say that. How could I say it? I'll say it like this. It's a dissociative thing that we do to protect ourselves, to make it not personal. Irving and Ernestine divorced when RuPaul was 7, and afterward he didn't see much of his father, whose absence he often describes as a primal trauma. Living with his mother, he witnessed her slide into depression and her sorrow at having allowed herself to be vulnerable enough to be heartbroken. A softness, RuPaul writes in The House of Hidden Meanings, that she viewed as an Achilles heel. The complicated and forthright portrayal of her in the book is one of its strongest aspects. It's my mother, he told me about his own guardedness. She said I'm way too sensitive, and she was absolutely right. So my job for a lot of time has been to hide the fact that I'm too sensitive. Attempting to appeal to his mother through her often Valium-laced distance, RuPaul would impersonate his favorite divas, wrapping a towel around his head to channel Tina Turner and LaWanda Page, who played Aunt Esther on Sanford and Son. Page later featured on the closest thing RuPaul's had to a mainstream radio hit, Supermodel, You Better Work, from 1992, providing the song's spoken word narration about a black girl escaping from poverty into a life of glamour. Performance soon became a kind of protection. I never fit in, he said. I wasn't one of the most desired things on the hit list. Television offered an escape, an early affirmation of his belief that everyone, everywhere, was playing a character. He liked Mission Impossible, with its complex nesting of disguises, each a layer of defense. In 1976, when RuPaul was 15, he moved to Atlanta with Renetta, who was in her early 20s. They were part of a wave of black newcomers seeking economic opportunity. He enrolled at the Northside School of Performing Arts, where he appeared in drag for the first time on stage, in the Tennessee Williams play Camino Real. After dropping out, he came into contact with a drag scene at a disco called Numbers, where he watched a queen named Crystal LaBeia lip-sync to Donna Summer's Bad Girls. By the 80s, Atlanta was drag heaven, Lady Bunny told The New Yorker magazine in 1993. Midtown Atlanta was a very gay scene. They had transvestite hookers all over the streets, day and night. When we started out, the Southern queens were deadly serious, without a shred of humor. But RuPaul embraced a genre of drag now known as genderfuck, a catch-all term for aesthetics designed to poke fun at gender norms. In The House of Hidden Meanings, he describes the look as mohawk and extensions, tribal apocalyptic, Thunderdome. Drag brought RuPaul his earliest sense of community, uniting him with kindred misfits. But with his striking height and confidence, and his new look, he also stood apart. I thought he had, like, fallen out of the sky, Larry T., the DJ and club promoter, who was one of his close friends and collaborators during that period, later said. I thought he was an alien. In those years, RuPaul was in a constant state of creative self-promotion. He started a series of musical groups, first performing as RuPaul and the U-Hauls, then as Wee Wee Pole. He made some of his earliest costumes on Renetta's sewing machine. Tasteful ones, he writes, like leopard print catsuits with fringe down the side. He began performing as a go-go dancer, then created his own avant-garde drag revues, which he brought to New York clubs like The Pyramid and Illusions. He advertised these appearances with posters bearing catchphrases like RuPaul is everything, and RuPaul is red hot, which he taped to telephone poles. I have never met anyone in my life that is as driven as RuPaul, the performer known as Floyd, another friend from that era, later told a documentarian. The first day I met him, we drank a whole bottle of Jack Daniels, and I was laying on the couch going, ugh, and Ru was like, let's go to Kinko's, let's make posters of me. The early performances could be political and often framed drag as liberation from oppressive norms. He opened one show at the Pyramid Club as a slave on a plantation. I hate being a slave, he said in a breathy Marilyn Monroe stage whisper. Then he rose to his feet, swimming in mismatched, oversized layers of leopard print, crimped hair wild, intoning in a baritone, I'm a slave, and you're a slave, and we're just going to break out. He put himself in front of cameras whenever he could. Once he wrote to an Atlanta public access variety program called The American Music Show, and insisted that, since he would soon be a star, he should be booked as a guest. The hosts of the program had never had anyone write to them before. RuPaul soon became a regular. With friends, including Lady Bunny, he made micro-budget short films on Super 8, among them the sexed-up slasher Trilogy of Terror, based on the anthology starring Karen Black. Another series of shorts, Star Booty, followed, with RuPaul playing a model-turned-spy in the mold of blaxploitation divas like Cleopatra Jones, reinterpreted in his Mad Max aesthetic. Really, it was just an excuse to change clothes, John Witherspoon, the director of Star Booty, later recalled. In the mid-80s, when RuPaul was making frequent trips between Atlanta and New York, he met Barbato and Fenton Bailey, who were in a pop act called The Fabulous Pop Tarts, but had aspirations to be filmmakers. They have different memories of the first encounter. Bailey told me that he was in a car in Atlanta, and, turning a corner, was confronted by an indelible image. There was this extraordinary creature pasting these posters, Barbato recalled, meeting him in the lobby of the Marriott Marquis in Times Square. He had football shoulder pads on, thigh-high waders, you know, rubber wading boots, and he was dressed like such a freak, Barbato said. And it was like seeing a huge star. I was dazzled. RuPaul sent Memorial Day of 1986 with Barbato and Bailey in a studio in Manhattan, recording an album built around the Star Booty character. Ru always had specific ideas of, I want this to sound like that, like he knew music so well, Barbato said. A few years after Star Booty, Barbato directed the music video for Supermodel, which featured RuPaul vamping around New York, chanting, Sashay, Shantay, before having a slapstick nervous breakdown, replete with snarling and wig snatching. The song reached number one on Billboard's Dance Singles chart, and the video was nominated for an MTV Video Music Award for Best Dance Video. It lost to En Vogue's Free Your Mind. RuPaul's earliest collaborations with Barbato and Bailey are among their most winning. For Channel 4 in the UK, the trio worked on a gonzo cable news series titled Manhattan Cable. RuPaul served as a field correspondent. In one segment, he walked around downtown Manhattan, like Dan Rather in a faux cheetah coat and platform heels, collecting the stories of sex workers. The meat market is filled with transvestite hookers by night, RuPaul tells the camera, and then, with a figurative wink, maybe I'll make my rent money. His exchanges with the sex workers are frank and sensitive. As a punchline, he gets into a client's car and drives off. The team had continued to build projects around RuPaul ever since. After experiments in different genres, The RuPaul Show, a talk show he hosted in full drag, ran on VH1 for 100 episodes. From 1996 to 1998. In the early aughts, they devised with another producer, Tom Campbell, the idea that would become Drag Race. RuPaul was initially reluctant. There was the meeting where Rup was like, I'll do anything but a reality competition show, Bailey told me, but eventually he was won over. Rup understood having the familiarity of a competition format would help us give something familiar to the networks. Every platform they pitched passed on the show, except for the LGBTQ+ channel Logo TV, where Drag Race ran for 8 seasons, becoming the network's most-watched program before moving to VH1 and then to MTV. As RuPaul became more popular, he changed his look to a less challenging aesthetic that he refers to as high femme glamazon. He writes about the first time he performed in a more feminine costume at a wedding-themed drag show, where he wore a white strapless dress with a Dior-style cinched waist. He felt some energy shift. I was finally getting sexual attention. The early forays into aggressive femininity represented his black hooker phase, he told me. By the time of Supermodel, however, he was moving away from such overt sexuality. The décolletage was becoming more modest, the gowns more polished. I desexualized all the way, he told me. The change was not universally welcomed. It caused a bit of a tiff from the other drag queens who he'd come up with in New York. They kind of labeled it as RuPaul Goes to the Mall. They were all angry, Jimmy Harry, who co-wrote Supermodel, once said. But I think that was necessary for him to kind of become a commercial entity. RuPaul's rise has made him a target for criticism with the queer community. In an interview with The Guardian in 2018, he wondered whether physically transitioned transgender women should compete on the show. Probably not, he said. It takes on a different thing. It changes the whole concept of what we're doing. The show has long featured transgender competitors, but early seasons were dominated by those who identified as gay, male, and cisgender. Gia Gunn, a contestant, told New York Magazine, "There were trans women who were putting their transitions on hold and purposely not taking hormones leading up to the show." Another contestant, Monica Beverly Hills, told the queer website Them that, "After a struggle to fund her transition through sex work, Drag Race helped me escape that world, but their world was never really made for me either." More recent seasons have had transgender winners, include Kylie Sonique Love, Willow Pill, and Sasha Colby. "I didn't have a single issue," Jinx Monsoon, who identified as trans femme during her most recent win on the show, told me. "Every season, it becomes more and more mindful of what's going on in the actual drag world. People want to call Rue transphobic, and I just think that's really hard for me to believe, given Rue's history." In The House of Hidden Meanings, RuPaul describes a life in drag entwined with trans performers, a community he speaks of with apparent affection. But he has built a career on sidestepping gender norms in a way that involves ignoring identity labels, which can be in tension with contemporary discourse. He doesn't much like to talk about the issue. "Gender is a concept that we come up with, in our minds, in our egos," he told me. "My genitals are male, but I can be whatever I can. I feel I'm everything. You are everything. You are male, female. Sometimes I feel more male than others." Criticism also followed an interview with NPR in 2020, in which he suggested that fracking, an environmentally destructive practice used to extract fossil fuels, was taking place on his husband's Wyoming ranch. RuPaul remains defiantly annoyed about the matter. "Do you buy gas?" he said to me. He sounds weary when discussing these controversies. "There's no combination of words I can put together that would soothe the mob," he said. Sam Lansky, a writer who helped RuPaul with The House of Hidden Meanings, told me, "He has been, in some ways, sort of misread in terms of his beliefs or his politics, contributing to a world weariness that he has, and this kind of pessimism that everything is going to go bad." In the memoir, RuPaul treats most celebrities he's encountered with diplomacy, if not reverence. An exception is Madonna, whom he describes giving him a snarl of contempt at a club in the 80s. "In aging, there is a natural flow," he told me, "and when you're against the flow, it doesn't look right. It doesn't feel right. The energy around the Madonna thing, it feels weird, right?" He referred to chasing arena tours and grills in your teeth. He added, "I'm not interested in appealing to 11 to 25-year-olds. I'm just not. I can, on a bigger level, as a mother. As Mama Ru, it's a different relationship. I'm not trying to be them." At Pinewood, RuPaul emerged from a bathroom, decked out for a non-drag segment of the show, in a Trina Turk suit with a swirling, psychedelic maroon print. Under fuchsia lights, a set for Snatch Game, a send-up of Match Game, awaited. In the segment, a staple of Drag Race, a panel of contestants, each impersonating a celebrity, attempts to complete a phrase, trying to match answers provided by celebrity guests. The episode's guests were Rachel Stevens and John Lee of the pop group S Club. Opposite them sat drag renditions of Elvis Presley, Liza Minnelli, Marie Antoinette, a dragon, and other characters. RuPaul, cue cards in hand, set them up for witty comebacks to questions. This was a light makeup day. For non-drag segments, RuPaul applies his own eyebrows, using four different products. Raven, the makeup artist, was nevertheless watching the monitors, and Kate's touch-ups were needed. She told me that she had worked with RuPaul on 7 seasons of television in 2023 alone. "I literally fill a suitcase, go home, fill another suitcase, go again," she said. Smothers corrected her. Lingo, a game show on CBS that RuPaul began hosting last year, had made a season 2. "It all kinds of blends together after 17 years, Smothers said, watching the monitors. Many of the Drag Race staff have worked on the show for a decade or more. For all RuPaul's boundary setting, the atmosphere can be unusually familiar for TV. Under the lights at Pinewood, the queen playing Liza Minnelli tried out an old standard, snapping, "I don't see how that's any of your business," and RuPaul howled with laughter. A few days later, RuPaul woke up and performed his morning ritual. First he stretched. Then he prayed, saying aloud the words, "Dear God, thank you," followed by things for which he is grateful. That week, the list included the roof over his head, his access to running water, and George, his husband, whom he met while dancing at Limelight in New York in the 90s. After that, he meditated, a practice that can last anywhere from 45 seconds to 15 minutes. He lets the ideas drift through. "Oh, there's my father. Oh, there's Judy Garland." His demons are there too, but he claims to have befriended them. He put on another black hoodie and another pair of black workout pants and walked 10 minutes to the nearest Marks and Spencer to pick up an apple turnover. Soon afterward, we sat in the living room of his rental cottage, a modest 2-story structure with neutral walls and a tiny kitchenette, to which he had added, as far as I could tell, nothing but a row of identical boxes of berry-flavored Special K. "I brought this in," he said, pointing to an LCD monitor that sat with his laptop on an otherwise empty white desk. "And I moved this chair. That's about it." Yet he was crazy about the place. He liked the flow of the floor plan and took pictures of it to try to replicate it in Wyoming. RuPaul is, in profound ways, a loner. For much of his adult life, he had felt alienated from the easy intimacy of casual gay sex. "In my 20s and stuff, when I was meeting someone at a bar or something, I always would want to find some type of connection, but it was not there," he said, "and I did not enjoy being with somebody I don't have a connection to." His black identity didn't furnish much sense of community either. "I come from a black family," he said, "but I always felt different. Not better or anything. I just felt like Rue." In the memoir, he recounts a moment 2 years after his move to Atlanta, when his father grilled him about rumors that he was having gay sex. "In the black church, gay represents something against the family. And the family is an extension of how black people survived from slavery," he told me. "So my existence becomes a threat to the family because I'm other than." I expected that he would suggest that he now relishes his role as a trailblazing celebrity in the black community. "I won 14 Emmys, and you would think I'd have been on the cover of Ebony, if that still exists," he said. "I don't represent what a black community wants to lift up. I never have." His computer's desktop showed a black and white close-up of Diana Ross. From an early age, he admired her ability to craft an image that was unthreatening to white audiences. "I went, that's what I want to do. I want to be on a world stage and not be questioned or make people feel threatened," he said. "Most black people in our culture have to not scare white folks." RuPaul told me that his social life is circumscribed in some ways by design. "I meet new people, but like socially, do I go out to dinner with people or meet someone and say, hey, let's go on a hike? Very rarely." He and his husband have an open relationship. "It's just realistic," he said. "There's no such thing as monogamy with men." Lansky, the writer, described to me what he thought of as RuPaul's foundational beliefs. Don't take anything too seriously. Don't treat anything as sacred. Stay in play. Nurture your inner child for all its profitability. Drag Race still ropes contestants into campy, small-budget music video shoots that mirror his own experiments on The American Music Show in Atlanta, creations with little artistry and lots of cheap wigs and improv. Before he dropped out of high school, a drama teacher scolded him for caring about his precarious academic career, telling him, "RuPaul, don't take life too fucking seriously." The admonition has since become a mantra. "I'm always looking to play," he said. "I want to be in that state all the time." RuPaul has been sober since the late 90s. In the House of Hidden Meanings, he described years of alcohol abuse that he now views as an effort to anesthetize himself, and also his eventual decision to seek treatment, spurred by his effort to help George, who was addicted to crystal meth. But he remains a proponent of psychedelics, and told me that early acid trips provided essential perspective on the importance of being in a state of play. That's why hallucinogens are so wonderful. "Because your self-consciousness is stripped away when you're tripping your balls," he said. The spiritual guru he finds most influential, he said, is my fucking idol Bugs Bunny, who is a fucking Zen master. His teachings: don't take other people too serious, and stay ahead of their stupidity. If you have to, build a fucking compound somewhere, but stay ahead of their own self-destructive, ridiculous mentality. RuPaul has been trying to outrun that kind of thinking for a long time. He recalled an appearance he made in full drag on the Arsenio Hall show in 1993, a radical act at the time. "In the moment, on Arsenio Hall, I'm up against the status quo and the machine," he recalled. "There is pain in that." He got up and served me that apple turnover. With his face shadowed by the hoodie and bare of makeup, he looked ascetic and almost otherworldly. He told me he'd been reflecting on his comment about not liking kids. "I would be a great parent," he said, "though he would fear sending a child into a world he finds inhospitable and dangerous," he added. "I would love that kid so much. The cottage is near a school." "The bell just rang," he said. "You know, last year when I took this place, I thought, oh God, the kids, they're going to drive me crazy. Now," he told me, "I fucking love hearing their voices out there. It's kind of this white noise of joy." That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I'm Harlan Levy, and I've been reading from the March 11th issue of the New Yorker magazine. So long, until next time.